Well, good morning, friends, and I am glad to be back. It's been a long time, and I've read every year in the American Baha'i with envy the reports of what has happened here at this conference. There's something special about the heart of this country, and I think Green Lake captures it when it gathers together so many of you and gives you a weekend of joy and upliftment and spiritual enrichment. And this morning, I've been asked to talk about transforming our families and communities. And in half an hour, I'm going to try to just sketch some ideas for you that I hope they'll be things that will make you go, Obviously, we can't go into depth, but if I can hit some high points, which will make you take a note and say, I need to think more about this, and I'm going to go home and talk to my family about this, and I'm going to go and see if I can exemplify this in my community, I will feel satisfied that this morning's talk has been of use to you. As I was trying to pare down what could be said, I decided to just address three key elements for transforming our families and communities, because really, as we transform the families, we do transform the communities. And as we transform the communities, we transform the families. Transformation means change. And little changes in each of us will yield rich, bountiful, huge changes in our community experience. And we also, I think, recognize that the primary need right now in the cause is for transformed communities that are capable of welcoming everyone, even the people that we wouldn't choose to hang out with. I mean, the faith of God is for everyone. Even the teenagers, no matter what color their hair, no matter how many holes they may have in their body currently, no matter how it is that they're learning about how to be adults. Now, I'm just using teenagers because many of you know that I'm really a youth trapped in an adult body, and I'm going to spend the most of my day with the youth and the junior youth. So the three things that I'd like to address are, first of all, one that Abdu'l-Bahá says, if we will do this, that we will specifically receive divine assistance. That's the first one. Secondly, one which, if we follow this, is a guarantee to a huge advancement to unity. And, by the way, will facilitate our ability to have consultation at a level we've never had before. And the third, if we can overcome this obstacle that I'm going to address, we will no longer inadvertently stunt the growth and development of the community. Are you curious? The first one that I was mentioning comes from a concept which all of us, I think, if you've been Baha'i for 5 minutes, you probably know this concept, which is that in consultation, when we offer our opinion, it belongs to the group, and we have to give it up. And if the assembly makes a wrong decision, we have to wholeheartedly support it. Now, we know this, and yet it is probably one of the most challenging things to practice in consultation. So let me share with you a statement that Abdu'l-Bahá made to Dr. Getzinger in 1917, which is recorded in Star of the West. That set of answers to questions that he had asked is very direct. I think Abdu'l-Bahá wanted to make sure Dr. Getzinger got the message because he doesn't pull any punches and he's very clear in this set of answers. And here's what he says about being right, because that's the first obstacle, a sense of being right. If you think about what prevents us from moving forward, oftentimes it's you and me in our well-meaning desire to protect the cause and to make sure that we do things the right way, clinging to being right and thereby inadvertently causing disunity. So let me read this statement of Abdu'l-Bahá. Blessed are they who are the means of making unity among the friends, and pity on those who, in the right or wrong, are the cause of discord. For instance, when one is right in a case in dispute and his minority prevents him from establishing this rightful manner. So Abdu'l-Bahá says, if you're right and you're not the majority voice, that's what he's talking about now. Instead of agitating the subject, instead of saying, friends, this is important, you have to listen to me, we can't do this, it's a terrible mistake. Instead of agitating the subject, if he will humbly submit to sacrifice his position for the sake of unity and peace. Now just listen to that phrase. I know you don't have the quote in front of you. If he will humbly submit to sacrifice his right position for the sake of unity and peace. Does this elicit a kind of an image in your mind? It's a lot like Abraham being asked to sacrifice his son. Think of it in terms of going to that altar of sacrifice, wherever that is in your heart, humbly submitting to sacrifice a right opinion when you really are right. And then here's what happens. God will accept the sacrifice. And ere long, the rightful matter will be established without any further dispute by the divine assistance. Whereas without such sacrifice and submissiveness, great harm might ensue. The friends must be prepared to efface themselves at all times. Seeking the approval of men is many times the cause of imperiling the approval of God. So that's the first one. Hold that thought. To sacrifice your right opinion. And you notice he doesn't say here, except when it's really important. I think if you're going to insert something in your own mind, you might want to say, especially when it's really important. Friends, there is no way that we can damage the cause by making a mistake. The House of Justice has reassured us of that. There is a way we can damage the cause by insisting on being right, because we're afraid that the cause might be damaged. Disunity is the leading cause of people withdrawing from the faith or being driven away by it. And if you think in terms of your own experience in your community or in your family, it's when there's disunity that you don't want to hang around. You don't mind. We could be all having purple napkins where everybody should really be having green. And if we're happy and unified, people are happy with us, right? So hold that thought then. Sacrificing the right opinion for the sake of unity and peace. And then be confident that God will accept the sacrifice. And ere long, he will make it right if we get out of the way. The second concept that I want to talk about is one which is very difficult for us here in North America, because we've made a kind of a pastime of it, I think, in the outside world. In the culture that we live in, there are certain things which are accepted and expected in terms of our behavior. And the one that I'm going to read a quote about is one which I think many of us have to struggle with because it goes against the grain of how we've been trained. And I think it will surprise you. This is a statement from Abdu'l-Bahá in a talk he gave, which is recorded in Promulgation of Universal Peace. He says this, "Act in such a way that your heart may be free from hatred. Let not your heart be offended with anyone. If someone commits an error and wrong towards you, you must instantly forgive him." I'm going to read that one again. If someone commits an error and wrong towards you, you must instantly forgive him. This is the crux of it, isn't it, friends? Because if you think about how we've been raised, taking offense is an art in this country. In fact, it's even part of the youth culture now. Dissing can get you killed, right? And so in this Baha'i culture, we're asked to actually turn ourselves 180 degrees the other way. Let not your heart be offended with anyone. If someone commits an error or wrong towards you, you must instantly forgive him. You notice Abdu'l-Bahá doesn't say that only if it really isn't wrong. I mean, you should only forgive them if it's just, kind of a little mistake. He says if they commit an error or wrong towards you, acknowledging that we do that with one another. So it doesn't matter the motive of the other person. It doesn't matter whether they're culturally sensitive or not. It doesn't matter. None of that matters. If a person commits an error or wrong towards you, your job, and the one you answer to when you take yourself into account tonight, is did I instantly forgive them? And then he goes on. That's the easy part. Listen to the rest. Do not complain of others. So I can't even go and complain to my friend or my spouse or my whatever about what has just the injustice that has just been wreaked upon me. Refrain from reprimanding them. So I can't even say, but now I got to straighten them out because they could go around hurting a lot of people. Right? What if they're really wrong and somebody's got to tell them? But Abdu'l-Bahá says, refrain from reprimanding them. And if you wish to give admonition or advice, let it be offered in such a way that it will not be a burden to the bearer. So they've just offended you, and you have to offer advice in such a way that it won't hurt their feelings. There's kind of a, I've always felt since I was a little tiny girl that there's a sort of a double standard in the faith, right? There's what I have to do an answer for, and then there's what everybody else gets away with. Isn't that true? You know, but friends, think about it. At the end of every day, when you take yourself into account and you're looking Baha'u'llah in the eye, you can only answer for what you did. And it doesn't matter how wrong they were if you've multiplied the wrongness by taking offense, letting your heart be offended. But he goes on. There's more. He then says, you know, he's just said, well, all the things you shouldn't do. Let not your heart be offended, right? And refrain from reprimanding them. Do not complain of others. If you wish to give admonition or advice, let it be offered in such a way that it will not burden the bearer. And then he says, turn all your thoughts towards bringing joy to hearts. So in the face of injustice, in the face of something wrong, then our thoughts have to turn towards bringing joy to those hearts. Now this is consistent with, Abdu'l-Bahá is consistent with himself. You can recall, I'm sure, many statements where he says, if someone gives you poison, give them honey in return. It's the same concept, isn't it? Yeah. The thing about it is, though, that if we kind of gloss over this and say, well, that's for the golden age, you know, that's, well, Abdu'l-Bahá could do that, but then, friends, we are neglecting probably one of the most important elements for transforming our families and our communities. And I want to tell a story on myself. The year after I was no longer serving as a board member, I also wasn't serving in any other capacity institutionally. It was a year of freedom for me. And while I had been a board member, I served for the entire Northwest, so I wasn't in my own community very often. And when I was, I didn't say very much because I was the board member for that community too. And in my absence, one of the members of our community had married a wonderful woman, and she had been elected secretary of the assembly, which had been my work for many years. And when I was free and then all of a sudden able to attend every feast, you know, you can tell my enthusiasm. So I was like, and what's the assembly doing about this? And da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And every time I would raise a question, what were we up to in the community, she would get very defensive. And I didn't realize until later that she was thinking that I was questioning the competency of the assembly, which I wasn't at all. I just wanted to know, fill me in, let me know, you know, here I am reporting for duty in my local community. And but she wasn't getting that message at all. And finally, I kind of backed off a little bit. And then something happened where I felt that the confidentiality of the assembly chambers had been breached, because my children at that time were planning to go travel teaching through Europe and end up in China. And they were raising funds, and they had met with the assembly to find out what they could and couldn't do in fundraising. And so the assembly knew what the situation was financially for them. And I got a phone call from a Baha'i on the other side of our metropolitan area, an hour's drive away, one day, very concerned that I was going to send my two girls to China with no way to get home. And I was a little bit surprised to receive a call like this from someone I hadn't talked to about it. And the only people we had talked to was the assembly. So the confidentiality of the assembly is the most important thing. And so I knew that I had to let the assembly know that this might have been a breach. And of course, I also knew who was going to open the letter that I would be writing. And I could predict her reaction, having already had some experience at feast. But I had to do it. So I wrote the letter, and in it I just said, I just want to bring this to your attention. You don't have to get back to me. It's not really my business what the assembly's doing, etc. And you don't feel that you need to respond to this. This is for the assembly's information. A week later, I got a phone call. The secretary was on the phone from the chambers of the assembly. We need to meet with you tomorrow night. And I had something scheduled that night, a deepening that I'd promised to give. And so I said, well, you know, if this is about the letter, somebody doesn't need to meet with me unless there's something more they need to know. Maybe we could do that on the phone because I have this other thing scheduled. She insisted. And finally she said to me, I won't be able to go to the summer school that we were all going to the following week if you don't come to this meeting. So I said, oh, okay, I'll rearrange things and I'll show up. I showed up at the meeting, and it was at her house, and there was maybe a quorum of the assembly there. Actually, I don't remember because of what happened. And sat down, we had an opening prayer, and then the moment the prayer ended, she just laid into me. I mean, she raked me up one side and down the other, spoke to me in ways I don't think I've ever been spoken to, accused me of being a cause of disunity in the community, all kinds of horrible things. She was really angry, and she was sort of throwing up emotionally. And I was shocked and hurt and confused and then appalled and then, oh my gosh, what if anything she's saying is right? And am I a cause of, you know the kinds of feelings you might have. And I couldn't say anything because really what I wanted to do was say, oh yeah, well, let me tell you about you. My lower self was very much in the dominant at that moment, but my higher self was whispering, if someone commits an offense or wrong towards you, you must instantly forgive them. And I began to pray, as the tears were streaming down my cheeks, and I wasn't saying anything, Baha'u'llah, help me forgive her. Help me forgive this, because I felt it was wrong committed towards me. And there wasn't anything I could say, and then the meeting, she seemed to feel better, and the meeting was over. And, you know, all these people on that assembly, except her, are my old friends. And my lower self was like, how did they do? Where were my friends when I needed them and all that kind of stuff? And there's a part of you that thinks, well, you know, if I just go talk to them, we can sort of divide and conquer here. And I mean, isn't that the way you feel in times like that? But it's friends that would be devastating to a community. So I just, that night when I took myself into account, I was answering for the fact that I couldn't forgive her. You know, forgiveness doesn't mean to say that it's all right. Forgiveness means to cease to feel resentful. When you look it up in the dictionary, that's what it says. I couldn't cease to feel resentful. So I prayed like crazy. It took me 6 weeks to instantly forgive her. And because, you know, we're taking baby steps here. I'm grateful that I knew that I was supposed to and that was my work, rather than to go and try and rally the community on my side and all the other horrible things that I could have done. Now, after this had passed and I began to turn all my thoughts towards bringing joy to her heart, which was hard in the beginning. You know, I wanted to sit in the other side of the room at feast, not next to her. Then eventually the assembly asked me to serve on a task force. She called me and she said, we'd like you to serve on this task force. And in my inimitable way, I began to ask questions. Do you want, you know, does the assembly mean this or does it want that? And I started to hear this defensive reaction from her. And because I had already done the forgiveness thing, thank you, Baha'u'llah, I was alert enough to hear her reaction. And I stopped and I said, wait, what happened here just now? I get the feeling that, you know, that you think something is going on. And she said, well, duh. You know, every time you're always questioning the assembly. And I said, oh, I'm not questioning the assembly or its competency. I just want to serve to the best of my ability. And that's why I'm asking all these questions. I want to know exactly what the assembly wants me to do so I can do exactly what the assembly wants. I would never question the assembly. I pride myself in being obedient to the assembly. And when I said this, and I wasn't saying it in a combatant or defensive way, there was a long silence at the other end of the phone. And then I heard her saying, oh, Erica, I'm so sorry. All this time I thought that you really thought you were just sort of better than the rest of us. You were a board member, da-da-da. You know, all the kind of jealousy sort of thing that had crept in. And then she began to tell me about her family and her family style. And all of this, of course, was very consistent with that. And we have become very warm friends, since then. In fact, a few years ago, I told her, I often tell this story in the strengthening unity workshops that I do around the country. And she, when I said that, you know, I tell our story, I don't tell them who you are, I just tell our story. She looked at me and she grinned and she said, oh, Erica, she said, you can even tell them who I am if it will help. And I said, no, that's all right. They don't need to know. So I tell this story on myself, really, as a concrete example of the kind of work we have to do. If you find yourself offended by someone, then the task number one has nothing to do with whether they were right or wrong in doing what they did. Task number one for you and me is that we forgive and turn our thoughts towards bringing joy. You know, friends, it's confusing out there right now because we have all this cultural training and et cetera, et cetera. We learn a lot of things, but what the world, the old world order is telling us in its well-meaning way is that we have to reshape ourselves for everyone else. But you just can't do that. Every family has its own style. Every culture has its own style. And we're bound to step on each other's cultural toes inadvertently all the time. I mean, personality styles. You can tell I'm a kind of a outgoing, upfront, out there person. And I'm sure that I step on people's toes all the time. Hopefully they forgive me because they can see my warm heart. But it's, you know, I rely a lot on your forgiveness because of my particular style. And I have the same responsibility to you. You can't turn yourself into a pretzel trying to make sure that you don't hurt somebody else because you will inadvertently do that. The solution is everyone not taking offense. Because if I'm offensive and you don't take offense, we don't have a problem. Right? We have unity in the community. If I'm offensive and you all take offense, we have a huge problem. And it's much bigger than whatever offense I might have committed. So I hope you've put that on your list. A list of things to do. The third one that I want to speak about is one which the Guardian characterizes as one of the first essentials for achieving cordial unity amongst ourselves. You know what one of the first essentials are is for achieving a cordial unity amongst the friends? Let me read it to you. If we Baha'is cannot attain to cordial unity among ourselves, then we fail to realize the main purpose for which the Bab, Baha'u'llah, and the beloved Master lived and suffered. In order to achieve this cordial unity, one of the first essentials insisted on by Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha is that we resist the natural tendency to let our attention dwell on the faults and failings of others rather than on our own. Did you know that? That's one of the first essentials for cordial unity in the community, that we resist the natural tendency to let our attention dwell on the faults and failings of others rather than on our own. And then he goes on to say, each of us is responsible for one life only, and that is our own. Now, you might be saying, yeah, but what about spouses? What about kids? And I ask you, in the short answer, because remember, we only have had half an hour together, the short answer is, when you die, who do you answer for? It's you. You're not responsible for how your kids take your parenting. You're responsible for how you parented. You may be responsible to be a helpmate to your spouse, but that doesn't give you criticism rights. Right? It gives you encouragement rights. So I'll go on and continue reading this quote. Each of us is immeasurably far from being perfect as our Heavenly Father is perfect. Have you noticed that? How many of us are imperfect? All right. Just a quick note. I'm going to talk about this more on Sunday. God created a really interesting system. One perfect being, that's God, and a lot of imperfect ones, that's us. And he made it that way and seems to be quite satisfied with it. So you love perfection because you love God. But the fact of the matter is, every one of us is imperfect. So it's easy to spot imperfections, isn't it? Because we were made that way. And that's part of the test, right? What do we pay attention to? He then goes on to say, the task of perfecting our own life and character is one that requires all our attention, our willpower, and our energy. Now, think about that. Attention, all your willpower, all your energy. Is there anything left? Probably not. If you can think of something, let me know. Because if I'm paying all my attention to me, then I really can't pay much attention to you. If we allow our attention and energy to be taken up in efforts to keep others right and remedy their faults, we are wasting precious time. And we could spend a lot of time talking about what a waste of time it is. But let me just offer you one possibility for your consideration. This kind of visual analogy came to me not too long ago when I was thinking about this quote. I often picture myself dead and facing Baha'u'llah. You know, it's like Baha'u'llah is the one I answer to, and I'm always thinking about that. And here I am. I'm dead. I'm facing Baha'u'llah, and he's human, normal human height, but I'm only about this tall. And I'm looking up at him saying, what happened? You know, what happened to me? I'm this little spiritual midget here. And Baha'u'llah, in that loving manner that you can assume that he might say, says, well, you had this much time, you know, human height time, 5'10", let's say. You have this much time, and you spent this much of it on other people. And so this is what you have left. So the guardian means it when he says, we are wasting precious time. Ask yourself the next time you let your thoughts dwell on the faults and failings of another, if it's worth it to you to lose an inch. He then goes on to say, we are like plowmen, each of whom has his team to manage and his plow to direct. And in order to keep his furrow straight, he must keep his eye on his goal and concentrate on his task. If he looks to this side and that to see how Tom and Harry are getting on and to criticize their plowing, his own furrow will assuredly become crooked. Now, I'm told by people who have actually done managed plows that if you don't keep your eye directly straight, you end up with a furrow. You can't look to this side and that at all, or your furrow follows your eye. Now, just in case you were wondering, is this really important? He says, on no subject, are the Baha'i teachings more emphatic than on the necessity to abstain from fault-finding and backbiting, while being ever eager to discover and root out our own faults and overcome our own failings. There is no place where greater emphasis is laid in the Baha'i teachings than on the necessity to abstain from fault-finding and backbiting. They're two sides of the same coin, aren't they? One's fault-finding, I tell you to your face what your problem is. Backbiting, I tell someone else behind your back what your problem is. It's the same thing, isn't it? It's looking at someone's faults. And he ends up by saying, if we profess loyalty to Baha'u'llah, to our beloved master and our dear guardian, then we must show our love by obedience to these explicit teachings. Deeds, not words, are what they demand. And no amount of fervor in the use of expressions of loyalty and adulation will compensate for failure to live in the spirit of the teachings. So, my dear friends, I've given you three things to think about. The first one had to do with being right and how it is never more important to be right than it is to be unified. And I think you can see the implications in consultation and everything else in that concept. The second, the requirement that we let not our heart be offended with anyone. And of course, you can see the implications in consultation there too. You know that's what we're required to do. And the third, that criticism is just plain not allowed. Not in the family, not in the community. Rather, what is allowed, and I'll close with this concept. I have a couple of quotes I want to share with you. What is encouraged, or what is allowed, is this. Abdu'l-Bahá says, the cause of the ancient beauty is the very essence of love, existing only that all may become servants one to another, adore one another, bless one another, praise one another, that each one may loose his tongue and extol the rest without exception, that each one voice his gratitude to all the rest, that all should lift up their eyes to the horizon of glory and remember that they are linked to the holy threshold, that they should see nothing but good in one another, hear nothing but praise of one another, and speak no word of one another save only to praise. You know, the House of Justice has recently told us that when encouragement and training are in place, success is guaranteed. And so the characteristic of the Baha'i community has to be one of encouragement, of not being afraid of making mistakes, of overlooking the faults, no matter how glaring they may be, and instead in seeing God in each of us. And I want to close now with a statement of Abdu'l-Bahá, where he says something that's really rather astonishing. O ye lovers of this wronged one, cleanse ye your eyes, that ye may behold no man as different from yourselves. This is the key for community, isn't it? That you see no man as different from you. See ye no strangers. Rather, see all men as friends. For love and unity come hard when ye fix your gaze on otherness. And in this new and wondrous age, the holy writings say that we must be at one with every people. But in the family, not aliens, but friends, and to be treated as such. Wherefore must the loved ones of God associate in affectionate fellowship with stranger and friend alike, showing forth to all. See, he's so categorical, all. There's no exception here, no matter how they've treated you. Showing forth to all the utmost loving kindness, disregarding the degree of their capacity, never asking whether they deserve to be loved. I'm going to read that phrase again. It just touches me. Never asking whether they deserve to be loved. When we can love one another in that tone of voice, then the love is real. And the community love is real. The unity is real. And the community is transformed. So I'll read that one more time and then finish. Wherefore must the loved ones of God associate in affectionate fellowship with stranger and friend alike, showing forth to all. Now think about who you might put in as an exception, personally. Who in your mind is going, yeah, but not that person? And then go back to the all. Showing forth to all the utmost loving kindness, disregarding the degree of their capacity. You're not the judge anyway about their capacity, right? Never asking whether they deserve to be loved. In every instance, let the friends be considerate and infinitely kind. Let them never be defeated by the malice of the people, by their aggression and their hate, no matter how intense. If others hurl their darts at you, offer them milk and honey in return. If they poison your lives, sweeten their souls. If they injure you, teach them how to be comforted. If they inflict a wound upon you, be a balm to their sores. If they sting you, hold to their lips a refreshing cup. And in another place, Abdu'l-Bahá kind of continues on. He says, in this way, the light of divine guidance will shine forth, and the blessings of God will cradle all mankind. For love is light, no matter in what abode it dwelleth. And hate is darkness, no matter where it may make its nest. May love make its nest in your hearts, and that will transform the communities. Thank you, friends.